So each academic term, Cambridge Ukrainian Studies tries to host a series of public events. And unfortunately, due to the COVID-19 epidemic, we've had to cancel our program for this Easter term. And what we've decided to do instead is to implement a series of less formal online conversations on different topics relevant to Ukrainian studies. So the way we've envisioned these online conversations is that they will take a general format, which will consist of about a presentation of 30 minutes, a presentation that can take the form of an interview or a conversation. And then this presentation will be followed by a question and answer period, during which I encourage our audience and anyone who might be tuned in to submit questions in written form. And I will be receiving them in the Q&A feature of Zoom. So again, pardon if there are any setbacks, because this is the first time that I am employing this format, but I look forward to receiving the questions from everyone listening. So we begin our new conversation series with a topic that I think is of immediate bearing, and it's the topic of coronavirus and the Ukrainian economy. So today's event, we will take the form of a conversation slash interview. And this conversation will take place with our special guest and our colleague here at the University of Cambridge, Dr. Alexander Rudnyansky. And he is a university lecturer in economics and the former chief economic advisor to the Prime Minister of Ukraine, Oleksiy Goncharuk. So joining Dr. Rudnyansky, Alexander, would you like to say hello? Or yes, you're on the screen.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. And joining Dr. Rudnyansky in conversation will be our own Andriy Smitsnyuk. And Andriy is the Ukrainian language teaching officer here at the University of Cambridge. So what I will do now is give the floor to both Andriy and Dr. Rudnyansky, and I will be taking the questions and posing them to our speakers after the brief presentation. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Olenka. So my name is Andriy Smitsnyuk, and thank you for coming here, Dr. Rudnyansky. As we all know, the situation with coronavirus is bad. The IMF announced that this might be the worst recession since the 1930s. So how bad exactly is it in Ukraine? Could you speak a little bit more on the situation in Ukraine?
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, it's very bad, just as everywhere else. Currently there is a lockdown, as almost all other countries in Europe have implemented. There's some variation in terms of the strictness across Europe, but Ukraine's lockdown is pretty strict. People do still go out, but in general, it's pretty strict and has come very early. So I do commend the government in that sense for reacting very fast. The current situation, however, economically is not going to be easy in any way whatsoever. Current projections for GDP growth are very negative. So the government says there's going to be about minus 3.9, I think, or close to 4% drop in GDP next year. So in 2020. That is, the IMF has actually a worse projection for GDP growth this year, so closer to 8%, minus 8%. And in general, obviously, the economy is going to react very negatively. So data on unemployment is slow to come in, but I just saw news today that unemployment has risen already by 22%. So that's not the unemployment rate, but that's the growth in unemployment. So all of these are kind of rough projections at this stage, but in general, the situation is clearly dire, and it's going to get very hard for people in Ukraine.
How is it comparable with other countries? Would you say that it's different from the situation in Europe or in the UK in particular, or is it better? What are your thoughts on that?
So yes, yeah, so there is kind of, we can split this question into parts. Sort of the first part is, what is actually happening in terms of the health statistics or how the epidemic is evolving. And in that sense, I think consensus US, or in terms of the statistics that we have, is that we're slightly behind the curve. So the situation in sort of Central Europe or the UK is much further along. So there's bigger rates of infections here, you know, more people dying at this point. Ukraine is kind of still in the early stages of the epidemic compared to what's happening here. In terms of the economic response, I think there's going to be vast differences. So Ukraine has actually, you know, already started to react. There's been a revised budget. There's all sorts of policy measures that are being put in place, but it's been doing it much more slowly, I think. And in terms of the percentage of GDP that is going to be devoted to actually combating this recession, it's a much smaller number than what we see all around Europe or Western Europe. So here on average, there's 10 to 15% of GDP that's going to be devoted to actually combating this crisis. In Ukraine, it's much less. It's somewhere closer to 2, maybe 3% of GDP. And that, of course, is going to have very, very severe repercussions for the recovery phase and in general how people will fare in Ukraine. Mm-hmm.
And what does it mean for average Ukrainians? What does it mean for those who are for senior citizens or small businesses? What are they experiencing now and what they might experience in the future?
Yeah, so again, this is kind of general to any country right now. So I think, again, we can split this in several parts. So obviously the situation is very hard. So this recession is not a typical recession. So that's important to understand. In a typical recession, you have a slowdown in demand, let's say. You have shortages in demand. And so usually it's for the government to step in one form or other to make sure they compensate for that lack in demand. So either through aggressive fiscal stimulus or maybe even an easing in monetary policy. Right now, we really have a new sort of recession that's really driven, we have to put on ourselves because of the health crisis, right? So in order to save lives and prevent our healthcare systems from collapsing, we actually need to optimally, in a sense, engineer this recession to prevent the rapid acceleration of the health crisis. So in that sense, you know, a standard fiscal prescription or a standard fiscal measure, depending on how it looks, might not necessarily be the right one. So demand is missing because people are actually confined to their homes in some sense. People are losing their jobs because they can't go out. So, and obviously you're asking me, how is this affecting people? Well, it's affecting them very negatively. They're losing their incomes, they're losing their jobs, and it's on the government, right, to essentially engineering this recession in one and also preserve the current ecosystem that is already established in one form or other to then be able to resume the economy as soon as the health crisis is surmounted, right? As soon as we come essentially out of the health crisis, we want to be able to just resume the economy, come out of this artificial freeze without destroying its structure right now, without destroying its interconnections and the architecture that's already in place. So this is quite a different design in a sense. It's a quite different situation compared to standard recessions. And this should be you know, what's guiding policy primarily at this point.
And what are the measures taken by the Ukrainian government? What does it do at the moment to deal with this?
Yeah, so I mean, as I said, unfortunately, the Ukrainian government has not been very fast, I think, and has not been very clear about what they want to do. But the policy should be kind of, again, you know, there should be several pillars in terms of how policy should approach this crisis. One key pillar is, of course, direct support to the people. So the Ukrainian government has promised some of that. It's not clear exactly how. So people, obviously, when they're, you know, losing their incomes, they need to have cash. They need to have some sort of income. So usually the government should step in with direct cash transfers or increases in employment benefits, whatever infrastructure is there to make this feasible, that should be used, right? As long as we're in this stage where we actually pause the economy, right? That's the one part, the key part, especially important for Ukraine because a lot of activity, economic activity, in Ukraine actually happens in the shadow or informal sector, right? So it's harder to support these businesses that are operating in the informal sector versus, you know, when they're operating formally as in Western Europe. So perhaps the most efficient and the easiest and less bureaucratic way would be to help people directly. Having said that, the second component, key component, is of course to help businesses directly. So small to medium enterprises are particularly affected in this recession, as we all know. Services, restaurants, retailers, all sorts of businesses like that are essentially losing all of their cash flows immediately, or have lost all of their cash flows, almost 100% of their cash flows. So, and this is again universally true for any country currently. So again, the government has to somehow engineer or design policies that are helping, that would help these businesses to survive at this point, right? To incentivize them not to lay off their workers, so to furlough their workers, for example, or to give their workers paid leave, right? And subsidize their salaries for some time, essentially, right? So this is, again, the Ukrainian government has promised some of that. So again, today in the news, I finally saw something that was kind of along the lines of what I suggested in this article in Ukrpravda a couple of weeks ago, which is, you know, credit line extensions, right, to these small businesses that would allow essentially at a 0% interest rate, right? So very, you know, basically very cheap credit that would be allowed, would be easily accessible to these small and medium enterprises, would allow them to actually service their liquidity needs when they need cash and they don't have any cash. So that's something that was just announced today. I saw it in the news, but in general, you know, you're asking me, what does the Ukrainian government do? This is what the Ukrainian government should do. I think they're doing some of this, but they're not being very transparent, I think, unfortunately, and they haven't been very fast. As I said, part of the issue is that we're actually very financially constrained. The Ukrainian government is severely financially constrained. All of these discussions are tied to, you know, getting new loans from the IMF, getting a new package from the IMF. Without the IMF package, this will literally spell disaster for Ukraine. So that is obviously a key component in also being able to fight the crisis. So all of these things are happening at once. I'm not saying it's easy. So I'm not, you know, I don't want to make it sound like it should be an easy thing to do, but this is still, there's no way around. The Ukrainian government has to obviously do all of these things, and the faster the better.
Okay. And you mentioned that without the IMF loan, it would be a disaster for Ukraine. But how bad could it be? Is there actually a possibility of sovereign default or not if they don't get the loan?
Well, the short answer is yes. I think there is a possibility of sovereign default, unfortunately, if they don't get the IMF loan. I mean, we've heard the members of the cabinet say recently that there won't be default, even if Ukraine is not going to secure an IMF loan. I'm not so sure, actually. So part of the IMF loan, of course, is to help Ukraine actually service its debt, right? So to roll over the debt, essentially. But another part of the IMF package would be to actually help combat the crisis. Now, both things are tightly interrelated. If you can't actually help the economy you know, come out of the crisis, that will make default, even if not now, at some point more likely, right? So this whole discussion in Ukrainian, in the Ukrainian political spectrum, has been highly, you know, controversial, very politicized, not very facts-based, I think. So people are blaming the IMF, people are not very happy with the IMF. But in fact, that is the cheapest and most reliable source of funding that the Ukraine can use right now. So it has to do everything that's possible to actually secure it. And we know, just from empirical studies, at the very least, that a default or even delinquency, right, financial distress at the government level is very costly. You know, it's costly to economic growth, it's costly to jobs. It's really not the not the best policy option, to put it mildly. So, yes. And in fact, what people don't usually mention when they discuss IMF loans or IMF interventions and packages in Ukraine is that, in fact, there is a lot of good, you know, positive case studies where the IMF would actually help countries in the past during times of crises, and those countries would come out much stronger. So, for example, the prominent case is, I would say, South Korea after the 1997-98 crises, the currency crises. You know, South Korea, already being a developed country, already being a tiger, actually did have to rely on an IMF loan, and a very big one, something around 48 billion, as far as I remember, to actually help it come out, again, service its debt, which was mainly at the bank level. So help its banks service their debt and make sure they implement, you know, deep structural reforms, pro-competitive reforms, and then actually come out much stronger. So there's many cases, this is just one example, but there's other examples. And there's many cases where the IMF did actually help countries overcome this. There's a reason why we have to rely on the IMF. So.
And the Minister of Internal Affairs, Arsen Avakov, actually suggested that Ukraine should restructure its debt. And is it possible to do now? And do you think that would be an effective measure or not?
So I'm not sure about this at all, to be honest. It's not clear how this restructuring would look. I think there's a negotiation between the government and the IMF that's been ongoing for a while now. It's been ongoing in the Gontcharuk government, in which I was helping, to advise. So I think, you know, whatever that means, I'm not sure it's going to be constructive to actually securing this package quickly for Ukraine. And again, if anything, it's going to there's a chance that this might mean that we have to somehow be delinquent or somehow face financial distress, right? Which is, again, very bad news. So I don't see these discussions as being constructive for what Ukraine needs right now, which is the IMF package, the passage of the banking law, this signing of the banking law. And the finally, of course, good news is that the Land Reform Act is finally put in place, or is going to be put in place with all likelihood. So that's already very good news. And so we need to finish these two policies, really put them into force, and then secure the package to finally be able to combat the crisis with full force.
And speaking of the new banking law, I think Ukrainian parliament has experienced a lot of difficulties with implementing it. Is it actually possible that they will vote for it anytime soon?
Well, I certainly hope so. There's procedures that, first of all, what's going on? So we see clear sabotage, right? We see clear political sabotaging of the banking law, which again is a key component in securing the IMF package. There's a reason we have it, right? Because we know from the past, speaking of IMF success stories and IMF failures, we know that those failures happened in countries where institutions were weak, when corruption was spread all across, and when essentially local elites were able to siphon off these sources of funds to themselves and not do any reform, not help the country actually prosper. So in order to exactly prevent that sort of scenario, the IMF is requiring us to do something, do our homework essentially on combating corruption, right? Making sure we actually go through a process of getting rid of oligarchs, getting rid of political influence that's toxic, right? So this is part of the deal, essentially. We need to make sure we do our homework here. And that's so answering your question, I think there are ways to, come around this attempt at sabotaging this reform process and getting the bill passed. But is it going to be easy? I don't know. So we see there is already something in around, 16,000 amendments, right, that they're being proposed, which would take, under normal procedures, months, if not, just an indefinite period to actually consider one by one. So there is shortcuts that the parliament can use to speed up this consideration of those amendments, right? And of course, the whole point is just to make sure this bill is blocked and never passed, and therefore we won't actually get the IMF loan. We can't let that happen.
Okay. And I also have a question about the National Bank of Ukraine. So there was a meeting of the Council of the National Bank of Ukraine, and they changed the monetary policy strategy, and there was a idea in Ukrainska Pravda, the economic news website, that they might finance the budget deficit through printing money. And would that be an effective measure? How could that, what could be an outcome of this?
Yes, again, so you see two sources, I would say, two big attacks on our economic policy that are very destructive, in my opinion. One is what we just discussed, this whole issue around Privat and the return of the former bank to its shareholders and the banking law. And the second part is everything that concerns the central bank. So the central bank in Ukraine is actually a commonly viewed success story. It's really the best, most professional and well-working institution in Ukraine right now. They've been successful in bringing inflation down. They've been successful, very successful, in cleaning up the banking sector. And more broadly, they're just, you know, a very competent team. And I have, personally, I have a lot of faith in them and in their skills. So I think Ukraine needs to rely as much as it can on this institution to progress with the reform process. So you see a lot of attacks, again, probably from people that are opposed to reform or opposed to actually Ukraine doing well in the long run, for one reason or another, perhaps because they have some sort of self-interest. You see a lot of attacks on the Ukrainian, on the independence of the Ukrainian Central Bank. And this piece of news that you just referred to is, again, I think, testimony to that, right? So printing money in a traditional sense, in terms of monetizing debt, is certainly not helpful. It's certainly not going to be helpful with controlling inflation. It's certainly not going to be helpful, therefore, with preserving the independence of the Ukrainian Central Bank. And it's not useful, actually, even if you think about it in terms of a monetary policy perspective right now, right? So again, just returning to what I started out with in the beginning of our conversation, this recession is not a typical recession, right? This is not a typical recession where we see a drop in demand, and so we need to use all tools to stimulate demand, essentially, either fiscal or monetary. So monetary policy normally, you know, by cutting interest rates, maybe expanding the monetary base, would be aiming to stimulate consumption, have people spend more, save less, and would also be aiming to stimulate investment. You know, by cutting interest rates, that would make investment look more worthwhile. But right now, because of the specificities of this recession, because people are confined to their houses, it's actually not compatible, right? So monetary policy in the traditional sense is basically short on ammunition. There's not much you can do anyway. And what we need to use, therefore, are fiscal tools, right? We need to currently stabilize the economy, make sure we survive through this period without breaking the whole ecosystem, the infrastructure of our economic interrelations. And then, you know, this is all the short-term policies. And then coming out of those short-term policies, hopefully with as few losses as we can then think about these long-term measures that will again be primarily geared towards structural reform in Ukraine. And perhaps over the medium run, depending on what will happen, monetary policy will again regain its ammunition in some sense, right? So we'll have a separate independent role. So I think this is just so misguided, this whole discussion about the central bank, its independence, printing money. It's not going to, it would not even have helped if we were able to do it, or if we were able to use monetary policy and just say, let's put away with central bank independence, let's just print money. It's not going to help us actually stimulate the economy right now. And in the long run, it's just going to lead to inflation. It's going to lead to a devaluation of the currency. It's not going to give us any benefits, right? So that's what I would say. There are things that the other governments are doing, which is somewhat separate from printing money, essentially. So you see the Fed, so the central bank in the US, for example, as well as in Europe, the European Central Bank, use quantitative easing again on a large scale. Quantitative easing is another form of monetary policy. It's a form of unconventional monetary policy versus conventional, where you cut interest rates. So quantitative easing is not, however, debt monetization, usually for the reason that it's going to be reversed at some point, whereas debt monetization is never really reversed. So it's just lending to the government directly and just, you know, giving money to the treasury. So quantitative easing, first of all, is reversed. This is a temporary action. And we actually saw quantitative tightening a while back before this recession, already in the US. And also quantitative easing, you have to have a whole financial infrastructure to really undertake it. So in the US, it's only allowed on secondary markets. So the Fed can actually purchase financial assets, whatever it is, mortgage-backed securities, treasury bills, on through secondary markets. And the objective there is, again, not to pump money directly into the economy without it ever being taken out, but to actually help, again, lower long-term interest rates, flatten the yield curve, stimulate lending, stimulate borrowing in some other sense, right? So it's, again, it's a measure to compensate for the lack of fiscal policy, as it was seen, for example, in the 2008 recession. That's not something that Ukraine has the infrastructure to do, in my view. We don't have as developed financial markets that are as developed to re-undertake quantitative easing. it's potentially something that people can think about going forward. But right now, as I said, monetary policy is not the primary tool that we should be using.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I have a question about the new Ukraine budget 2020. So there was a lot of debate about that. There was a scandal. Some people accused the parliament of taking money from education and culture without necessity to do so. What do you think overall about the new budget?
Look, so I think all these issues are very contentious. I can understand people on all sides, but I think, you know, to keep my answer short, primarily right now, given that we're in this crisis, given that GDP, GDP growth might be minus 10% this year, given that people are losing their livelihoods, with all due respect to education and culture, we need to preserve what we can, but we also need to make sure people preserve their livelihoods in the short run, right? Yeah. So given that we're short on funds, given that we're financially constrained, given that we, as I said before, don't have those 10% or 15% of GDP that are being made available to actually, you know, help people come out of this recession, preserve the infrastructure of our economy. I think this whole discussion about let's take some amount back to education or some amount back to culture is just, again, completely misguided. It's making us lose time, and it's creating a huge bottleneck, essentially, in the political process. This is something that we can return to in the medium run, immediately, maybe next year already, as soon as we're out of this recession. So I think that's just the short answer. More fundamentally, I think, you know, when we talk about kind of the medium run policies or even the long run policies, again, there's a whole set of issues here, right? So in order for Ukraine to really come onto a path of long-term prosperity, we need to cut the role of the government. We need to make sure that we actually provide a long-term stimulus through tax cuts, for example, through a simplification or a huge reform of the tax system overall, which is still very complicated and interest-bound, right? We need to make sure our labor markets are actually flexible and not dating back to 1977, right? Or in the 70s, basically the Soviet labor code. I mean, we need to make sure that we can actually, and again, this is relevant right now. We see this in this crisis. In order for us to come out as quickly as possible, we need to have, you know, people working, being able to work flexibly, being able to be remunerated or paid flexibly. None of that is actually allowed or, you know, considered or allowed for in the current labor code, right? Because it's just so outdated. So we need to make sure we push through all these structural reforms as soon as we can, once we're actually overcome this health crisis in the short run. And that's going to be the policy that's going to put us back onto the stable growth footing, right? And it's going to allow us to actually build up our economic potential to the fullest. And I don't see this being discussed at all, actually, right now. What I see is people being, you know, all this infighting about should we spend more on education, should we spend more on culture. I'm not sure this is going to be useful to actually overcoming these big challenges.
Okay, I understand. And I guess we're running out of time, but I still have one last question before we go to Q&A. What do you think, could there be an impact on the war situation in Ukraine? What will be the impact of coronavirus recession on the war in Donbas?
Yeah, Andriy, so this is a very good question. I think it's a hard question to answer. So my take is this. So I think in terms of foreign policy for Ukraine since 2014, the name of the game has really been expect the unexpected, unfortunately. This is just something we have to face. We can't really do much about, I think. That's why I'm always for just concentrating our efforts on what we can do within inside Ukraine. Economic policy, structural reform, really the difficult things and not the minor things. Making sure we're actually the most economically free and attractive country in Europe, right? So that people actually notice this rather than just promising, just putting out empty promises and not really delivering on them. So, but as far as foreign policy is concerned, I think there is increased risks right now, of course. Much depends on how this health crisis is also going to play out in Russia. And Russia is actually facing similar issues as Ukraine. Its fiscal response is deficient. But its political system is very different from ours, right? It's much more authoritarian. So you never know how they're going to react when crises become, when the crisis becomes very steep for them, right? So there is a risk of escalation potentially in Ukraine to just take attention away from the internal problems in Russia, as we've seen in 2014 to a large extent. But I hope it doesn't happen. This is all speculative. I really hope it doesn't materialize. There's huge costs for Russia as well in escalating the crisis. So the answer is, I don't know. I hope we won't see an escalation in the war.
I think we all hope for that. Good, thank you. It was very educational for me personally as a language teacher. So thank you. And I guess now we can go to the questions. I think Olenka, could you?
So there are a number of questions, but before I start reading the questions that we have received, I was just wondering if you can tell us how do you get the money to the people? If you mentioned something like tax reforms, but won't tax reforms take a long time? How do you get money immediately to the people?
Yes, Olenka, that's a great question. So tax reform, exactly. This is why I mentioned it in terms of the medium-term policies, right? So as soon as we're out of this health crisis, which we will be out, hopefully with very few losses or the least amount of losses that we can in terms of lives and in terms of livelihoods, so the economy, the question then will become, how do we actually get out of this economic infectious state, right? So the state of a depressed economy, how do we stimulate? And here is actually where people might have different opinions, right? So some people say, look, the government needs to spend more, or we need to use, you know, some sort of policy. Other people might say, look, we need to rely less on the government and more on the private sector. So my view is that in Ukraine, given the state of our institutions, given the level of corruption that we face, we have to make sure that we rely on these not very well functioning institutions as less as possible, right? So we have to really base our growth on the private sector going forward. And that's why I say, you know, fiscal stimulus can come in two ways. It can come in a way of spending more on the part of the government, or it can come in the way of actually cutting taxes so that private enterprises or just individuals are incentivized to spend more, invest more. And I think that's the better way in Ukraine. I think that's more, it's kind of more consonant more generally with the structural reform process. It will also take into account the fact that we have a corruption tax in the in our system. And so if we take the government and ask it to spend more, just part of these resources are going to disappear because of that corruption tax, versus if we rely more on the private sector where we don't have that corruption tax as much. So I think that's just a much better way. And it's also consistent with attracting more foreign investment when we have a simplified tax code, when we make ourselves attractive to actually produce and invest into Ukraine. But again, this is all, as you rightly said, this is all in the medium run. In the short run, how do you get money to the people? Again, unfortunately, we don't have a great infrastructure to rely on. But in principle, there's two ways. And there's some debate about that right now, although more broadly a consensus. So either direct forms of help. So in the US, you see people just getting checks, essentially, mailing checks from the government. So giving people cash directly. It could be unemployment benefits, an increase or a prolongation of unemployment benefits. In Ukraine, you have that, but the problem with, the problem with this infrastructure is that it's very hard to do without face-to-face interactions and actually applying for these unemployment benefits, making sure you obtain them. So there's some costs and some trade-offs involved in actually implementing these policies. But one way or other, we have to make sure people get some support. So pensions have been increased actually recently in Ukraine. And that's potentially good news because we see that the elderly, the people on receiving pensions are generally more exposed to the virus, more exposed to the health crisis. So if there is this understanding that we need to help them most, we need to help them with self-isolation as much as we can, then perhaps increasing pensions right now is not just a populist move, but is also economically viable. So this is another way of doing it in the Ukrainian context. And the fourth way potentially, or not potentially, but quite importantly, is actually to make sure that in the Ukrainian context, we help with utility bills, right? So what's called ZKH in Russian or Ukrainian. So we have to make sure that People have an easier time paying these bills. Either subsidies are increased or they're completely covered for the time being by the government. So again, that will minimize on face-to-face interaction, and that will help people actually overcome this period of income shortages.
So I feel I have a question that is related to what you've been saying just now from Robert Marukoa, and I apologize if I mispronounce someone's surname or name. And Robert asks, in the US, small businesses, my son has a law firm in Detroit, will get loans if they keep their workers, which will be forgiven. So the loans will be forgiven. Ukraine is in more dire economic straits. Is that policy of forgiveness a possibility if some IMF funds get to Ukraine?
Absolutely. So many countries have implemented forms of this policy, and that's precisely one of the components or one of the recipes that governments should use. So, you know, there's credit help can come in a lot of forms. So there's credit lines that are actually even more useful, I think, in these particular instances. The difference between a loan and a credit line, just broadly, is that, you know, a credit line is kind of like a credit card. So you can tap into it, especially in times of crisis, to cover your liquidity needs if you're short on cash. So the central bank, again, can help implement these mechanisms, right? So they can help implement it through the banking system. One of the advantages, essentially, perverse advantages right now in Ukraine is that much of the banking system is government-owned. Usually that would not be a good thing. And kind of the long-term strategy, again, in terms of financial structural reform, is to make sure that the role of the government decreases in the financial sector. But right now, when you actually need to help these enterprises, it might be an advantage because you can implement this policy more quickly. You can just order the government, or the government can just order these things to come into effect, right? So they can help extend credit lines. They can help with evergreening of loans, which is another fancy kind of jargon, which basically just means companies or people are not required to repay their loans immediately. So they can be postponed indefinitely or for some long periods of time until they can actually do it, until the economy is recovered. So the short answer is yes, absolutely. This is a key component in terms of what policy could do.
Okay, we have a question from Andrew Titko. And the question is, how big is the informal economy in Ukraine?
Again, that's a great question. Because it's informal, it's actually hard to say precisely, but there's a variety of estimates. And on the upper end, those go up to 50% of GDP. So potentially half of our economy is actually in the informal or the shadow sector, which is of course very bad news, and we need to do something about it. So if you look at, you know, just as a kind of tangential fact that's kind of relevant to this question, if you look at countries in our region that have been successful with reform, Georgia really stands out, in my opinion, and kind of just more broadly, I think people agree. And what happened in Georgia is that actually in the beginning, once they started implementing these structural reforms, which we still can't do, their economy was growing, you know, at an incredible rate. And the reason for that growth was precisely because most of its activity was coming out of the informal sector and becoming formal, right? Not because there was a doubling in output necessarily so quickly, but just because there was actually an increase in how much of the economy was being, or how much of the activity was taking place in the formal sector, right? So there was less tax evasion. There's people actually that are now formally employed versus just getting paid in cash. So this is a key priority for us too. So we need to make sure there's going to be less tax evasion, and the formal sector of the economy really becomes much larger, with the informal sector shrinking over time.
Okay, thank you. Our next question is from Alex Reeds, and the question is, if the COVID-19 crisis worsens in the coming weeks, do you think President Zelensky will be forced to reach out to big businesses and oligarchs for financial support, especially in Ukraine's regions where state support is less prevalent?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. In the Ukrainian context, we see those sorts of agreements, you know, come into force sometimes. So when the government actually reaches out to the oligarchs, essentially, or to big business, to kind of step in and help out because of institutions being weak more generally. So I have mixed feelings about this. I want to say that, you know, part of this has already been observed. So we saw Zelensky meet with business representatives a couple of weeks ago to essentially ask for their support, providing equipment, cars, I think machinery, some infrastructure to actually help with the medical needs. I think this is a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, we want everybody to help as much as possible, and it's good if big business helps, but it's bad if it's actually tied to some, behind the doors agreements that are actually detrimental to our deeper structural reforms and our institutional development, right? So we don't want these business structures to substitute in permanently for a well-functioning state. So I think this is a double-edged sword, and it's a task of the government to make sure that we do this correctly, so that we ask everybody to contribute what they can contribute, but that we also, everybody is helping with actually building institutions, combating corruption, making sure that, again, we grow the formal sector of the economy.
Okay. Christopher Geary asks, my understanding is that Ukraine is adopting a policy based upon limiting the spread of coronavirus through some form of lockdown and hoping that the already stretched health care services can cope. However, with limited testing and limited capacity for testing and tracing, what is the strategy for coming out of lockdown and avoiding a second wave? Until that is clear, there will be no economic recovery?
Yes, again, great question. I think this is an issue more broadly, not just for Ukraine. Testing has been something that people emphasized very early on as something that's pivotal both to, essentially to overcoming the health crisis and therefore helping the economy. Unfortunately, so me personally, I've been reluctant to reiterate that too much, just because I feel that's more on the epidemiological or health side. But of course, there's a tight interconnection to the economy. The issue is that it's easy to say, look, we need to do good testing, but of course, it's much harder to implement. So we see in Europe, for example, already now that everybody knows that testing is pivotal in the fight against this virus, in actually overcoming the health crisis, but just the infrastructure is missing, which explains this huge difference between what we saw in Asia, right? For example, in South Korea, which has been very successful primarily through testing and containing the spread of the disease and therefore keeping its economy more or less active and open, versus what we saw in Europe, where nobody was prepared essentially, and we saw a huge spread, we saw a huge rise in infections and very little testing early on. So now there are some differences. Germany in particular is doing much better along these dimensions with testing, and I think everybody in Europe is starting to realize that they're having more success. But it's just very hard. It takes time to actually build the infrastructure, make sure you have the right tests, make sure you're testing in the right spots. You're not getting infected at these points where you're testing, right? So in Ukraine, that would be a huge challenge. You already saw lots of hospitals being just infected all around because people weren't doing it the right way. So this is why I refrain from becoming, going deep into this issue, just because I'm not an expert in epidemiology or not an expert in how viruses spread and how you prevent them from spreading. But of course, testing is a key component, but unfortunately, it takes time to really implement it the right way. I think the government is doing what it can. So as opposed to some other governments that are actually preventing tests from importing these test kits from abroad, Ukraine has been kind of active in pushing for that. So Ukraine has imported a lot of tests from China, for example. I don't know how they're actually managing this on the ground, how they're spreading it across hospitals. But I trust that they're learning how to do it and they're using frontier methods. So I hope I have answered that question.
Thank you. I will ask you two more questions and then I believe we have to finish. So the question is from Leo Beer. And the question is, will the consequences of this pandemic make Ukraine slide backwards towards oligarchy, away from the reforms of recent years? If the national government has limited cash and the country is already struggling to find foreign investors, how can the public be confident that oligarchy is avoided? I think similar to a question we've gotten.
Yeah. Previously. Again, this goes at the heart of, the challenges that we face. We have to do our best, right? Make sure that we actually don't go back to more authoritarianism in some way or, more power for the oligarchy. Of course, the crisis is always a risk that something will happen. But hopefully our democratic institutions are already strong enough to make sure that doesn't happen. I think there's as opposed to, you know, some years ago, let's say maybe even 5 or 6 years ago, I think there's a widespread consensus in Ukrainian society now that the oligarchs are really not particularly helpful as an institution, if you want, for Ukrainian progress or for growth in the long run. So I think that's going to be very hard to reverse. And that's good news. However, that doesn't mean that this is going to be an easy battle or an easy way forward. Right? We still have all the oligarchs in place. They still wield extensive powers, as we see. They're able to sabotage the reform process. They're able to obstruct the reform process. So we need to make sure everybody understands that this is exactly what's going on and that we can overcome this.
Thank you. And our next question is from William Dubnin, who is a student of Ukrainian mm-hmm. studies here at Cambridge. And he asks, in what specific ways is the current economic crisis affecting or likely to affect the war in Donbas and plans for peace talks between the warring factions?
Right. So we spoke about that with you at the very end, right? So as I said, I think, unfortunately, there is a risk that something might change in the east of Ukraine. And I think saying that this is a risk, you know, things might escalate just because there's two sides involved. And one side being authoritarian always has the incentives to kind of deflect from its internal problems and, you know, focus attention on some external conflict. So we already saw that happening in 2014. Given that this is a new crisis, and given that popular support for the current Russian leader is not very high amid in the face of this crisis, there is a risk that there's going to be new attempts to deflect. I hope it doesn't happen. The fact that we kind of understand this is a possibility makes it hopefully less likely to happen. But you never know. So this is, as I said before, expect the unexpected. All we can do is to actually be economically as strong as we can, which is why we have to focus on making sure we progress, making sure we actually implement structural reforms. We actually become the most economically free country in Europe. We make ourselves attractive to investment and to growth in the medium run, after we've overcome the health crisis, of course, all of this. But there's little else we can do, right? So we have to make sure nothing escalates in terms of the war in Donbas.
If you permit me, I'll ask one more question.
Yep.
So Ihor Oleksiev asks, how would you deal with growth of the unemployment rate in Ukraine, considering the limited resources of the government?
Yes, I mean, all of these issues are huge challenges. Of course, one thing we have to do right now, there's not going to be anything else that we can do, is to make sure we get the IMF package. The IMF package is going to allow us to do much more than we will be able to do without it. So that's one thing that I would just say. So there's nothing novel about this. We've been speaking about this all along. But this is a key component without which things will be much harder in helping the unemployed. Otherwise, in the short run, it's the policies that we've outlined. So it's helping people directly. It's providing cash to them. It's making sure their businesses are frozen but not delinquent or not bankrupt, right? So that, you know, if we let these businesses, small and medium enterprises, fail, we basically destroy our whole business infrastructure that we already have established. And that's going to make this recovery just so much more difficult. It's just going to prolong the recession, because we know just from economics and just from how economies function, it takes time to find new jobs. It takes time to match with your employer or employee. Now that if we allow that to happen, if we allow these firms to fail and to actually break up in terms of their working relationships, we will just prolong the recession because of that, because of these matching frictions, essentially, at the very least. So we can't let that happen. We have to make sure we support businesses as much as we can during this freeze, this artificial freeze, and we help people survive this period without getting infected. And we can do that. Again, what can we do? Well, we can get the IMF package, and we can make sure that we put funds available to these programs to support.
OK, Okay, I would like to thank everyone who's attended this first online conversation that we're hosting, and I hope you will join us for further such events throughout this physical isolation period until we can get back on stage and actually host you here at Cambridge. And I would like to especially thank Dr. Oleksandr Rudnyansky for speaking with us, and I have to say that you have my vote for being the chief economic advisor.
Oh, thank you.
So I hope that the government sees how lucky and fortunate they are in having such a thoughtful individual. So thank you very much. Thank you, Andriy, for hosting this with me, and I hope to see everyone again at our next online conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.